Hello. This is a recording of an event held at the State Library of New South Wales. This recording was made on Gadigal land where the State Library of New South Wales stands. Lands that have been cared for and nurtured by the Gadigal people for millennia and have an incredible history of storytelling and creativity. We pay our respects to elders past and present. We hope you enjoy this recording.
Thanks, Lydia. Hi, everyone. Welcome. I'd also like to echo the acknowledgement of country and to note that we are on stolen land, and I want to pay my respects to all elders past, present and emerging. It's a real pleasure to be here today for this In Conversation event with Ellen Van Nieuwen, otherwise known as Evan. This is a really significant and really timely book. Sports writing in Australia is in a funny space where new voices are trying to crack in and new stories are trying to emerge. And this is a really significant, I think, intersectional story. It's not just about sport, it's about identity, it's about politics, it's about culture, it's about history. And it's about how we move forward as a nation through the prism of sport. So it's really fabulous, and I'm really privileged and really proud to be here to chat to Evan about it today. So I'll let Evan kick it off.
No. Is that good? Yeah, cool. I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of this place that we're gathered today, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and pay my respects to the people of this place, the ancestors of this place, the elders of this place, and in particular reference to where we are today and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people that are present today. It's really great honour to be here, and I come from Queensland. My mob are Mulinjali from southeast Queensland. Both my mum's parents were born in what's known today as Bow Desert, which is an hour south of Brisbane or Yuggera and Turrbal country, which is where I grew up. And my dad's Dutch. And so I think, you know, particularly with my dad's influence, who you know, gave me my first football at a young age, and my mum's family as well, being very sport obsessed, every sport, it was always going to be in me to kind of write a book about sport, but also very much about country and about what it means to be here on stolen land. So it always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
You almost stole my intro there, Ed. And most folks in this room know you as Evan the poet, mm-hmm. whose work sort of ties the personal and the political, particularly through the lens of identity. But this book takes you and your writing into a very different kind of direction, which is sport, and particularly football. Why? Where did this idea come from?
Yeah, I think, you know, it was sport was always there from a young age, but also writing was there from a young age as well. But I think I first had the idea for this book in about 2015. And so I guess a lot was happening in 2015 for me personally. I was still playing at a pretty relatively high level in Brisbane. And I was also, my first book, Heat and Light, had also come out. So I was playing in the Brisbane Premier League, and Heat and Light had come out. And so I was like missing a lot of like training and games and stuff because I had to, you know, do literary stuff, which was great. But also it was the first time in my life that I felt like I had to kind of choose between the two. I always just wanted to do both. And so, you know, some of my like most wonderful memories are those weekends where I have been able to do both. I have been able to play and then you know, go to a literary event or something, or go to something that's really beautiful and moving. So, like, one of my favourite memories is when I got to be on stage at the same time as the late Uncle Archie Roach at the Judith Wright Centre, which was, really incredible, and performed some poetry. But then I had a final, that's like a local final, on at the same night. and I had this beautiful neighbour drive me from performing, you know, to the final, which was in Carina. And I was, you know, putting on the kit and this is probably something you're familiar with.
Anyone else play football in the room? You know what this is.
Putting on the kit, everything, while I was in the car, and getting to the match on time and being able to play in that final. So memories like that were are particularly strong with me. But it wasn't until... it was around that time in 2015 that I was sort of feeling, you know, that that false binary that you talk about, where sports people will often some sports people will often talk derogatory about arts, and some arts people often talk in derogatory ways about sports. So arts people, you know, in a very stereotypical way, will say that sports is like for bogans and for bigots, and arts people, and sports people will say that you know, the arts is like stuck up and snobby and exclusive. And that's absolutely not the experiences that I had growing up, particularly coming from a big Murray family. Like, it was just so inherent that we would do both, and that there wouldn't even be a divide or a conversation, that both were just so valuable to who we are and who we always have been. Yeah, I think at that time I was like kind of dipping into that territory of feeling that tension, and I would show up to poetry readings wearing my jersey, and I would mention, you know, books and stuff like that in the sporting environment, and like I just felt like I kind of had to rep both. And so I was feeling kind of really like thing about it, and so I was just like, you know what, I think there's definitely something in this that I want to write about. I want to write this book. It did take a long time, if you think that the first kind of thread started in 2015. But it's going to be something that, in some ways, you know, of course, when you're writing a book, you think of your readers, but it was something that I owed to myself more than anything, this personal conversation with myself. And also, there's a lot of memories that I had growing up playing from the ages of 11 to 25. These emotional, physical, social landscapes, I'd never travelled outside of where I lived until I started playing. I experienced time through sport. So I wanted to sort of capture those memories that I had of those places, those times, those spaces, write them all down before I forgot them, basically, and they're woven into the book. And the book just takes sport and runs with it, because it's such a conversation starter that, you know, we could be talking about all of the issues that sports covers for all night. You know, there's just so much territory there, I guess, that I wanted to talk about.
And you do. You cover a lot of ground in this book. It's almost difficult to sort of categorise it, because on the one hand, it is a memoir. It's a sports book, but it's also, it's laced with poetry and history and commentary and interviews, almost journalism. Is that sort of a reflection, I suppose, of you wanting to build something that sort of connects all of these different pieces together, as opposed to, I guess, a more traditional linear kind of sports writing narrative?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's very deliberate, I think, in the way that it's sort of presented and woven together, and it is all those different things. I think I just wanted to like really push against or like write kind of whatever you saw as the conventional sort of sports narrative. I wanted to push like all those barriers aside and kind of write my own thing that was going to be different. And I think it's even just pretty like transgressive, even just for me, as someone like me, I guess, to write about a book about sport on this continent and in this kind of reception environment that's so white male, so kind of, yeah, so just kind of doing something that would kind of just make my mark on and kind of in being in conversation with other people along the way and be a gathering of stories. And I think, so what I tried to privilege in this book was emotion, also tension, there's contradictions, and fluidity. And so that's kind of how I wanted it to read. And I did that because the form reflects what it's like to play sport on this continent. It is full of contradictions. It is full of tensions. It is full of emotions. But it also reflects the connection that we as First Nations people have with sport. And in that way, it is this dynamic and constant ceremony. It is this boundary-breaking thing. It is this barrier-breaking thing. And so I took inspiration for those things in how I wanted the form to reflect that.
At the core sort of this book is that contradiction you mentioned, mm-hmm. and that relationship between sport and country, sport and land, sport and place. In the opening section, you ask some pretty profound questions about this, starting with, what does it mean to play sport in the context of colonisation? Mm-hmm. What prompted this question for you, and why do you think that sport in Australia has been so slow to acknowledge its role in the ongoing colonial project?
Yeah, that's a good question, a big question, I think. I wanted to kind of think about, what sport was, we have our own versions of sport before colonisation, and we have, so I wanted to sort of write about that, and the way that we saw sport, it was not through the prisms of lines and making sort of, barriers and boundaries, as I sort of mentioned before. So if you think of like a swimming pool and how kind of, vertical and boxy it is compared to, swimming in the river or swimming in the ocean, that's just a sort of snapshot of like First Nations perspectives on country compared to potentially Western compulsion to control and to kind of box things in. And so I went, in this book I kind of went right back to thinking that I write this in the book, conversations about sport are not honest if they don't reference dispossession and displacement. So I just wanted to sort of start with that and start with a little bit of truth-telling about what happened in particular to the place that I'm from and where I live, Southeast Queensland. Write that history, write about the attempted genocide of our people on the East Coast. More than 90% of us were wiped out, and also those murdered, and also those places that we hold such strong connections to were also stolen. And how that plays out in sport in particular is the research that I did, it's very concentrated to Southeast Queensland, but I think it would be similar in other places around Australia. Often, places where mob... that we deliberately cleared sites for ceremony, and these places became all different, had all these different purposes. Sporting grounds, cultural grounds, ceremony grounds. The kind of our versions of churches and schools and art galleries and museums, because these places were already cleared. They became what is now known as, now our sporting fields that, that will be in this city and in the city that I grow up in. So those places had this, archive of information that was then kind of whitewashed by settlers, and were chosen to be those, early settler sites of sports, and now that continues. So I really took that. When I just sort of thought about that, it was so deep in terms of thinking about how much time we spend in those places and how, how if we sort of find out more, then that can kind of enrich understanding of place and being on place. So, you know, definitely sport is complicit in a lot of violence towards First Nations people and country. Even, you know, thinking of figures like Tom Wills, who is sort of seen as the founder of AFL, how he was involved in a massacre of 40 First Nations people in Queensland, but is sort of that history is kind of being whitewashed in and only kind of recently sort of talked about with any sort of complication. So you can really just scratch the surface and see that there's so much that sort of still needs to be resolved. And I think why sport has taken so long to kind of have those conversations is essentially settler sport in this country is about land and it's about power. And it does have this history of violence. And so, you know, these are all things that are held close and also covered up. And so, yeah, it's going to sort of take a while before we can, I think, this nation can have those conversations. And, you know, my book talks about some of those questions, but, you know, really to resolve it, you know, it's really the question of land and stolen land, and I'm sure I'll talk a little bit more about that later, but that's really at the kind of the heart of thinking about what it means to play sport on stolen land.
The way you deconstruct and then reconstruct the concept of sport through a First Nations lens is really powerful in this book. As you mentioned there, you know, you take us into the history of some of these sporting places and spaces and the way in which settler culture has just sort of barreled over its own history and almost created a kind of widespread amnesia that we don't remember what these places used to be. We just know what they are now. You take us into the history of Aboriginal sports and games, which were played without the dynamics of competition or hierarchies or opposition or even gender categorisation. And you talk about how a sport is still used almost as a weapon of assimilation. I'm thinking about the AFL going out into remote communities and giving opportunities to young kids only for them to emerge into an organisation like the AFL, which is structurally, as we've seen recently, still incredibly racist. Mm-hmm. How has your understanding of sport changed as a result of engaging in these ideas, exploring these questions, and coming out the other side of this book?
It was, I guess it's sort of, to answer that, it was through having conversations with people, but there was a really, you know, as you said, there's so much contradiction in sport as being sort of something that has so much good attached to it, but also so much bad. So I was talking to beautiful Leah Shepherd, who's a UQ researcher, and she, so I talked to her in this book and with her permission have used some of her quotes. And so she's researching sports for development programs. She talks about, you know, this carrot stick approach of using sport as this kind of sort of almost like this false reward, because it's not, you know, in some ways what it offers is deceivingly it's smaller than what is kind of off on the table, and that sort of approach being sort of replicated of what, you know, mission systems use to missions used to treat Aboriginal people. So using sport as this carrot stick, she also talks about these programs being interventionist. So these programs sort of targeting talented First Nations kids, you know, and AFL is one example, but other sports do this as well. And sort of, you know, going into the community and taking, you know, the talented kids to go to, you know, to elite schools or to join these programs. it does, in the way that these programs are set up, it does cause a lot of issues. And I'm talking very generally, of course, but I think, you know, for one, what if you're a black fella and you're not good at sports? Like, does that mean that you feel like you're less than, you know, like there's a stereotype that you have to be good at sports and then you're going to have these opportunities? But then it also puts a lot of pressure on kids, family systems, you know, kinship systems as well. It's like almost this other form of mining or extraction of, like, because in, you know, maybe not coincidentally, some of these places are also places where huge resource extraction is going on. So, you know, we'll fuck up the country, but hey, we'll give your kid a good scholarship. So it's almost like, you know, mining land, but also mining the community of their deadly, you know, football players or whatever. So it's like, yeah, it's a really fraught thing, especially when sport is kind of used as this kind of thing of like, we're giving you something. Like, I think I'm just going to quote from Janine Lane's poem, which I quote for in this book. In this chapter called Sport, you know, this section called Sporting Interventions, Janine Lane's poem White Fellas, it's about rugby league, but it could be applied to any sport. So Janine writes, white people are happy to say that rugby league has done a lot for Aboriginal people, even though Aboriginal people have done a lot for rugby league. So it's like total kind of thing of like, hey, you're not really giving us anything. We actually give you a lot. I mean, if you got rid of all of the great moments of black excellence, sporting excellence on this continent, then what you would, you know, you would lose so much. You would lose, you know, Kathy Freeman, Adam Goods, our beautiful First Nations footballers, Harry Williams, Kaya Simon, Lydia Williams, Karen Menzies, Bridget Starr. You would lose so many amazing moments and amazing people that have changed the chart of history of sport on this country. But, you know, white fellas say, hey, you're lucky that to have these sports. So I think, yeah, I think it's really fraught to, yeah, long story short.
TLDR, it's complicated.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, but I think, yeah, obviously sport is something that has a lot of positives as well. And I think, you know, it's really something that a lot of us blackfellas, we love, and it's part of our community. And I think, you know, I talk as sort of a kind of a, what's the word, like as an example, a good example of that's the opposite to these, you know, these programs that are kind of using this white model. I talk about the Koori knockout in this book as, you know, example. It's 50 years and, you know, tying into the exhibition, which everyone should go see, and the, you know, also the beautiful Pride exhibition as well. That these are examples of community coming together. You know, as it's been called, a modern day corroboree, and all the, you know, lots of codes have their version of a Koori knockout, and states as well. And having this kind of festival of sport that it goes beyond, you know, winning and all of that kind of that ugly stuff that we don't like about sport, which is like winning at all costs and, like, you know, breaking your opposition down and, like, having this division between people. Really what I learned about writing this book is that, you know, and it comes from the wisdom of one of my Yugambeh elders, who writes that, you know, really everything Aboriginal belief is all about land and all about people and how we treat land and how we treat people. And so that's also what I've now feel strongly to sort of say, that I think sport should be all about how we treat people and all about how we treat land.
The language of sport as well is quite interesting in that sense. It's so warlike. It's all about opposition and attack and defence and all that sort of stuff. So to be able to find a new vocabulary for sport, which is more about connection, which is more about play, enjoyment, fun, community, I feel like that is, should be perhaps part of the larger cultural shift that we go through.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree. Yeah.
Sport, the way that you address it in this book, is not just a community issue. It's also clearly a very personal one for you. On the one hand, it's incredibly liberating and empowering for you as an individual, particularly in your body. But on the other, it's very prescriptive. It's very suffocating. It boxes you in. Have you found a way to reconcile these contradictions, or has writing this just made them a bit more pronounced?
Again, such a good question. I feel so ambivalent. Like, I feel in between, because it was such a good exercise for me to write this book, because it was a way to sort of engage some of those painful memories, you know, things that maybe I wanted to forget, but sort of engage them in a place of sort of safety and understanding now, and sort of pride in who I am. And so talk about all those contradictions of how sport has made me personally feel, but others feel throughout their lifetime. I just love sport. I can never be one of those people that just think, well, I respect them, but just think, you know, sport is got too many problems, too many, you know, have to sort of walk away from it completely, because a lot of people do. A lot of, you know, queer people do that. But I think writing this book was a part of me. I guess I learned to love sport even more, because I felt like it was this conversation that I wasn't just on my own, but I was having with other people, and it was just a way to sort of put it all down and weave it all together.
For a book about sport, this is a book that's also quite erotic. Sex and sport are intertwined in some really interesting ways, especially in the essay Personal Score, which is the title of the book. Why does sex, especially queer sex, play such a prominent role in a story about sport?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, Sam. I think there's this, you know, this embodiment that is, you know, there's a lot of similarities between sex and sport, and it's, you know, really kind of riding the body, and it's sort of, it's kind of really... you know, feeling, you feel it in the body, you feel it's a language of movement and expression, and it's both mental and physical as well. I also really wanted to, a couple of reasons why I wrote sex in this book. I know the section that you're talking about in Personal Score, you know, the teammates, the rivalry, the kind of, you know, there's a lot going on in that particular chapter.
It's pretty hot.
Thank you. You have to read it. I think we were saying that, I think it would be relatable to a lot of people as well. I think it wasn't something that I had seen in literature before, so I wanted to sort of write this sort of stuff as a way of owning it and claiming it and sort of claiming that kind of body space. I also write about pleasure in a very intentional way. I think there's the beautiful writer, the Cree writer called Billy Ray Belcourt, and he writes a lot about Indigenous joy, and sort of in very deliberate ways to sort of frame joy as a resistance to colonization, ongoing colonization. And so I write pleasure for similar reasons, I guess. And so it's sort of a deliberate thing to sort of put that on the page. And it totally makes sense because, you know, sport itself is very pleasurable as well, and we get a lot of pleasure from sport. I also wrote it just as sort of a road any sort of lingering shame and guilt that I felt growing up in some very intensely queerphobic environments, some being schooling environments, some being team environments. You know, I had a kind of mixed bag, as I think a lot of us do, in terms of some of the team environments that I was in were extremely queerphobic, and then particularly, you know, kind of the ages when I was, you know, still figuring out who I was. And so there was all that kind of, yeah, it was just really intense in thinking about how to, you know, if this is what people think queer people are, like if they think that they're just so horrible, then what am I, who am I, how am I going to navigate this space? And then, of course, you know, we have really incredible queer-friendly environments that we play in as well that are hugely affirming. So I guess, yeah, I just wanted to write, about this space and just sort of, yeah, kind of really just reclaim that space. And it did make sense. They didn't feel like they were hugely separate things. It sort of did make sense to sort of include it in this book.
And it's not just sex, but also gender and the identity sort of discoveries that you've been through since sort of embarking on this journey. The coming to consciousness, I suppose, of your non-binary identity. What role has sport played in those discoveries for yourself? And how does the sort of ongoing colonial project of gender, I suppose, continue to affect people in sport who fall outside of the binaries?
Yeah, okay. So when I was, I think I always have felt like super non-binary. I just have all these memories of like being young and like I was like playing with the boys, playing with the girls, and then you sort of get to a certain age where they're like, no, you know, you can't play with both. Like it just becomes so kind of rigid. And so I remember like this was, you know, when I was young, like 11, 12, I remember I found that like really weird and hard. And there was like so much like gender policing and kind of stuff when I was growing up that made me just feel really shit. And just, I guess it really did sometimes, kind of heighten, on the sporting field where people would sort of say, you know, is that a boy or a girl? Like those sort of comments, like when you're a young person and not really know how to sort of respond to that and be like, well, it depends on what day of the week you ask me that. So I think, you know, I think it's not just queer and or non-binary and or trans people that feel or have felt the really intense, rigid gender policing in a sporting environment where, you know, there's only a certain way to be, you know, you're either too masculine, too feminine, you're too this, too that, like there's this heightened attention on the body, it's not this, it's not that, and kind of people can be really turned off sport because of this attention on the body and this kind of this really, you know, as Dr. Sandy O'Sullivan writes about the colonial project of gender, which I really encourage everyone to check out their writing, they're a Rajari scholar. It's, you know, based on these very, you know, rigid Eurocentric colonial models on what, you know, how to kind of be, and how, and particularly, you know, with the erasure of gender expression and sexuality on this continent, which is, you know, extremely diverse. You know, I think you also, it was also intentional to disrupt kinship systems, and also, yeah, so, you know, so much was sort of around sort of having these white supremacist views of what a woman or a man, or just not only having this kind of binary category of what people could be, and erasing those, you know, sovereign genders that have always been here. And so I think lots of people get affected by this really strict gender policing and this sort of toxic gender stuff that it kind of affects people across the board, and it makes people feel sort of ashamed of who they are, and I think it does really sort of play out on the sporting field, and so yeah, I think for me it was like totally learning so much stuff along the way while playing sport. It's sort of people's reactions to you, but also, you know, conversations that you have with people that are super affirming.
Women's football in particular seems to be a much more progressive space in the context of global sport when it comes to inclusion, when it comes to diversity. You talk a lot about the women's game in this book. You mentioned the Women's World Cup. You mentioned the Matildas. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the W League. We've got our captain, Sam Kerr, is openly gay. Women's football has had the first trans non-binary person to win a gold medal. Quinn, who played for Canada at the Tokyo Olympics. Mm-hmm. Why do you think there is such an overlap between these two communities? What is it about women's sport or women's football and the queer community that has so many parallels?
Good question. But firstly, who's got their Women's World Cup tickets?
Yes.
It's just going to be so... I'm so excited. I've got... My friend actually kind of got me some grand final tickets. So we, 2 months from now, we'll be witnessing history, which will be really cool. And I think, is this something that you've been waiting for your whole life? Because, I definitely have been. It's just going to be...
Anyone who knows me, yeah.
It's going to be so good. But I think, back to your question about representation, I think definitely women's football has, representation. How awesome is Sam Kerr? How awesome is Quinn? Huge, role models, I guess. I guess there's still, if we think about the whole, LGBTIQA plus community, I think there's still so much that sort of still is not fair and not right and not, and so there's so much discrimination within, that kind of, I think I write about in my book because I think, in particular, trans women and trans girls, in women's football, face barriers to being able to play, whether it's trans exclusionary policies or, abuse for playing. And trans women in sport is just this constant kind of media beat up, and I think about, how that might affect young people that are sort of listening to that and thinking about, that they don't have a place in sport. So that's what I write about in my book. Until all of us are liberated, we're not liberated, and so we can't forget about all, as much as we have this queer representation in women's football and we have this non-binary representation as well, we can't sort of forget, or we need to kind of acknowledge the trans misogyny that occurs in sport, and also in some ways, also I think as well intersex women, are not included, and I think there's still a long way to go in terms of that inclusion and that conversation, and just for, a young trans girl to just kind of be like, yeah, I'm just going to strap on my football boots and I'm not going to feel like, I can just be myself. So I think, that's kind of something that's constantly on my mind. And I think about why do we have, so many queer out athletes in our sport compared to the men's sport, Josh Cavallo being the first male player to come out in the the male professional league, you know, globally, right? Like first, you know, being in the first division, like that was huge. And then thinking about, well, why is, you know, women's football more inclusive to queer people? And I think it's, you know, I think it's largely because, you know, our communities are really strong. We sort of have had to make our own communities through sport. And potentially, you know, there's a little bit more of an old guard in men's sport that is, you know, that kind of has that kind of, you know, that gaze on it that's really quite intense, and that old money and that institutional sort of stuff that, I'm sort of still kind of thinking that through. But I think, yeah, I think it's like, there's so much representation, but there's always room for more improvement. And, you know, if we talk about the two countries that Quinn and Kerr represent, Australia and Canada, well, there's plenty of other countries in the world where, unfortunately, to be, you know, to be queer and to play sport is just not even an option, to be outly queer or non-binary.
One of the other parallels I find between those two communities is that there seems to be a shared experience of living on the margins. Women's football has not had any kind of attention. It hasn't had any kind of gaze to force it down a particular road of presentation. Yeah, so perhaps that's why there's so much overlap.
Yeah, I think so. Like, it's just amazing, like, you know, talking to you the other day, and, you know, some, I know I look forward to Sam's, you know, articles in the lead up to the World Cup, because there's just this, you know, so much amazing history, recent history that we don't know about, you know, that of, you know, the Matildas having to sort of pay their way and sort of having to kind of do so much, you know, the calendar, all of this sort of stuff that a lot of, you know, general population don't know about. But sort of, yeah, it's like that having to do it all for themselves and for each other, and sort of, yeah, I guess it would really create some really, you know, incredible bonds, and also like a really kind of a spirit of resistance, and sort of empower and you know, achieving what seems impossible.
Absolutely going to keep talking about the World Cup, because it has consumed my life for the past year. This year's tournament actually is significant for a number of reasons, and one of those is that it's the first to use Indigenous place names in the official tournament branding and Indigenous designs. How do you view things like this? Because this is FIFA we're talking about, mm-hmm. right? This is big sport. This is an organisation that historically does the extraction. They go and, mm-hmm. and they participate in this commercialised, highly unethical practice.
Yeah.
And yet now they're engaging in what seems to some perhaps to be a bit of virtue signalling, mm-hmm. borrowing these things to make it seem like they're moving in a more progressive direction.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see this kind of move? Is it more complicated than that? Are they trying to do a good thing in the right way?
So is this the use of place names? Yeah, I think, you know, it's a complicated answer because, like you said, some people might think it's just window dressing, but it is significant, I think, and it is significant that, you know, this is the first tournament to do that. I think it would be really, and, you know, we have also, you know, First Nations, an artist that has designed the design profile and the artwork of the, you know, the tournament. So that's significant as well. I'll go back to that later. But I think, so the names, you know, having visitors to this place, you know, coming here and having that, those names there and you know, getting them sort of curious about, you know, the history of this place, First Nations connections to this place, how to sort of have those names in their on their tongue and in their, you know, in their vision, I think is significant, and it goes to, you know, acknowledging that we are on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander land and that we will be travelling throughout this tournament on this. And then, you know, the design, the artwork as well, you know, like it definitely, you know, it's definitely is significant because, you know, artwork is very, for us as black fellas, is story. If you think about the Uluru Statement of the Heart, it also includes this artwork to sort of show that, you know, that's, you know, that's the way, that's so inherent in our, you know, culture and our tradition in telling story and representing story through art. So I think, you know, both combined is definitely a step, but of course there's so much more that could be done to engage in that space and, you know, thinking about people coming to this tournament from all over the world and wanting them to know and experience the culture of the place that they're on and the stories of the places that they're on, I think will be really, you know, really something that I hope can happen through many different ways and potentially there could be a lot more, but it's definitely a start. I think about, you know, Lydia and Kaya and how they really kind of laid the way in our Matilda's team being very aware and very strong in their position in terms of recognising and celebrating First Nations culture and how they always come out with the Aboriginal flag, how when Kaya and Lydia were in Canada for that, you're going to have to help me with the World Cup in what year?
2015.
I could use you. Like, this sports facts stuff is going to be really helpful.
I forget way more important things, actually. It's all just football stuff.
Lydia and Kaya actually went out of their way to engage with the local First Nations people on, you know, in Turtle Island in Canada where they were playing, so that they kind of lead the way in the sensitive engagement that the team now has as well. And so, but also, you know, we have so much history that we need to remember and we need to celebrate. And I think, I think, you know, there's so many ideas that can go towards that space. We're definitely only just touching the surface right now.
What more would you like to see in that sense?
Yeah, how much time do we have? I think, well, firstly, I think, you know, sport, every sport, so football is not excluded from this. In some ways, it's really important to have this, you know, to look back at, you know, in historical racism and institutional racism as a first step, but then think about, you know, how to kind of promote story through the game. And so, you know, and sort of go about correct protocol in doing that. So I think, you know, I really don't have time to think about that. I think, you know, I deliberately refrain from using the word decolonization too much in this book, because in some ways when you use the word decolonization, some things just can't be decolonized, basically, so that's full stop. But also decolonization is kind of this easy word for a process that is very, very difficult and very time, you know, takes a long, long time, and it does become this buzzword that's easy. But even if we just sort of sit with the question, I do think it is a good question to just think about, you know, how can we decolonize sport, to just kind of open up this sort of question. And I think if we all thought about that for a while, that we would have, you know, a really good idea of some maybe small steps that could happen. But yeah, it's about kind of starting this conversation and sort of seeing where it goes.
In the final section of your book, you do list a number of things very generously that you think would help and lend itself towards decolonising sport. But at what point, what do you think sport would look like once it gets to that point?
I think the list itself, I think, is a generous gesture, because I think really we are talking, you know, we are talking about, you know, being on stolen land. So, you know, that needs to be addressed. You know, as my cousin Grace said, you know, it's like the first on the top of that list is like land back. You know, like I think we really need to think about, particularly about country, we also need to think about climate crisis and how ongoing colonization is accelerating that. So that would be something that potentially could be highlighted in this tournament, and thinking about, you know, all these kind of stories, you know, think about the Torres Strait Islander 8 fighting, you know, for the against the rising sea levels, against, you know, there's so much on this diverse continent that is happening that sport can sometimes accelerate, but also just pretends that it's benign and sort of greenwashes. So I think, you know, that's a moment in itself. For me, when I think about, and that's why I use, you know, just in, even just using sport, you know, sport, we have our own like words for sport. So in, you know, there's a word Mughalin, which is also the name of a playwriting company based in Sydney. It's a Bundjalung word that means to play. So there's all these alternative words to sport. So I think when we think about sport, we're thinking about it through a Eurocentric gaze. When, you know, of course there's other ways of looking at sport and how sport has always been, you know, something that has been incredibly relational. So I think we need to think about, you know, restoring relations to country and relations to people. And so, you know, you have left me with a very big question. As hopefully I've sort of started to answer that question in this book.
It's my final question, because I can't leave an interview with someone who's a women's football person without asking, who's going to win the World Cup?
Well, I don't agree with what you wrote in that email when you... So Sam emails me like see you tomorrow, whatever, with... am I allowed to kind of out who you...
Go on, yeah, all right.
Sam reckons Germany is going to win. What do you guys think about that?
Shocked hushes across the room.
Okay. Yeah. I think...
America? Yeah, America? Matildas?
Anyone Matildas? Yeah. Come on.
Love the optimism.
We have to go for the Matildas. I'm not answering that question. Or maybe we'll talk about it later on in the tournament. I'll wait until there's two teams left and then I'll tell you.
Oh, well, that's sort of the end of my official list of questions. But as I tend to do in a lot of my interviews, I wanted to ask you, was there anything else that you wanted to take the opportunity to talk about, or anything else that you wish someone would ask you about this book?
Yeah, thanks so much. Can I say that I want to read a poem?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, cool. Would you be keen to hear a reading? Yeah, yeah, great.
So, you know, this poem, you know, for a lot of you... I have to kind of give some background, because it was written in 2020. So it was about, like, I think we were sort of in lockdown. I might sort of get you to hold that.
And then, sorry to just break the awkward silence. After the reading, if anyone has some questions... We've got some time to send a microphone around for four or five questions if people are keen as well. So just put up your hand and there'll be a mic that's passed around.
Sorry about that. Thank you. Need more bookmarks. that's a good use of post-it notes. I love that. So I wrote this when we were like kind of in lockdown. In 2020, and thinking, you know, about my optimism of this tournament and what it could look like, and, you know, my, you know, feeling that women's sport can change the world. And so, yeah, it's about this World Cup. There are some notes about the poem. So it was before all the teams were finalized. So some of the teams that I mentioned are the countries that are competing are, you know, speculation. It mentions Nick Cave, but it's not the Australian musician. It's the African-American queer performance artist, also called Nick Cave. And I also mention Saha Kadayari, who she was a supporter of her, you know, local team in Iran, and she attended a match in Tehran, and she was told that women couldn't go to matches, and so, you know, the day after she was in court, she set herself on fire outside the stadium, and unfortunately passed away. And so this poem mentions her as well. And it also mentions Eagle because as Yugambeh people, in particular Malindali people, our totem is a wedge-tailed eagle. And we see the eagle as, you know, guiding the way and protecting us from the skies. So this is called 2023, as imagined in 2020. In 2023, we will not keep our realities to ourselves. There'll be black fellas on television narrating joy instead of survival, and I will rub my eyes until the vision is seen and believed. In 2023, Aotearoa and Australia will host the party of all parties, the whole world watching. A 32-team competition will open doors. Our neighbours, Papua New Guinea, will qualify for the first time. Iran's national team will honour Saha Kadayari in a blue strip. In 2023, no fires will burn so wildly out of control. Sacred business in the hands of First Nations practitioners. In 2023, I will go to the supermarket and fill a shopping cart of food from black businesses, knowing my Unipons sustain country. 2023 brings me closer to the question Cave asked, is there racism in heaven? I'm not sure yet, but I know I will rest when I'm dead. And we will keep our face masks on hand. We will be taking all precautions not to piss off our planet again. The virus is around like all living things. But if we are talking about something that deliberately and callously kills, yes, police and state violence will be suppressed. And what kills us historically will make us stronger. In 2023, we will disbelieve a time where women went to jail for unpaid fines, children were handcuffed, refugees were imprisoned indefinitely. It will seem so long ago. In 2023, our politicians will reflect what this country has always been, a place of deep spirituality and respect for every little thing. The state election will be contested by two First Nations candidates. In 2023, I will recognize my face is more like an eagle's, older and stronger. My eyes have never been so fixed. In 2023, outside Mianjin Stadium, kids will be backflipping like Sammy, forward facing the truth. Megan Rapinoe's allyship will no longer take centre stage, and our Matildas will have three First Nations players in the starting 11. A dramatic penalty shootout will see Australia make the final through a Lydia save and a Kaya conversion. The final will be played to 80,000 fans. They will not allow tickets to bigots. The crowds will descend on Caffey Freeman Park, and I will call my mum and say, even if we don't win the final tonight, we have won.
Did anyone have any questions? Yes, great.
Reminiscent of Canberra. Sam mentioned and touched on Quinn and Sam Kerr and, you know, what both of them mean to the queer community. And I guess, what do you think this tournament is going to do to help showcase the queer community, not only to the rest of Australia, but to the world? Because I feel that there is still a lot of the country that will, you know, barrack for the Matildas. They'll descend on this tournament, they'll have tickets, but they'll either be innocently or deliberately oblivious to what's in front of them. So what do you think having, you know, queer players from all these different countries descending on Australia for a month-long tournament do to showcase the queer community to the rest of this country? And I was reminded of this because there was a video this morning that flashed across my Twitter timeline. Sam will know exactly which player it was. It was the Dutch player who was in the interview and got asked about, her partner. And the reporter went, ideal son-in-law, and was corrected for ideal daughter-in-law. And it's just this, you know, innocent mistakes that continuously get made by journalists because they don't do their research and they don't know. So, yeah, I guess what's this tournament going to do for the rest of the country?
Yeah, well, firstly, it's going to be very hot. thank you so much for your question. I think we have come a long way in this space in the last 10 years, if you think about how, you know, players on this level, you know, in our Matildas, felt, you know, that it was, you know, risky to disclose their sexuality, and of course, you know, that risk still exists, but, you know, we have this incredible sort of, you know, space for, you know, people like Sam Kerr to be these incredible role models and just sort of be like, you know, she's the most recognised sort of one of the most recognised sporting faces that we have. She's the most recognisable face in football that this country has, and she's an openly queer woman of colour. So it's just really, you know, I think, you know, hopefully that, you know, the, you know, in the case of, you know, you're talking about that, you know, that ignorance, I think there'll just be a lot that will happen with just these people being themselves and hopefully feeling safe to be themselves in this country and, you know, in places like this city, which has just recently had World Pride. So I think it will be like World Pride version 2, but better. I think maybe you're right in terms of like the sort of mainstream media not anticipating how much this means to us as queer people, and how much this sort of space is going to be, you know, have so many of us there. So I think it's going to be a really interesting space to watch, I think, this year.
Thank you for your question. Anyone? Yeah, at the back of the room, sure.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been such a delightful yarn to listen to. Ellen, I wanted to ask, I know that you were writing this book for a long time. Is there something that's happened since you, like, had the proper locked-off edit that's happened in the space that you're addressing in personal score that you wish had made it into the book, that you couldn't get it in?
Well, firstly, hi, Jazz, darling. How are you?
Good.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. You have to kind of draw a line, you know, otherwise you'd be writing the book forever. And the thing about sport is it moves fast, you know. It's like the news. Sport is the news, you know. 20% of news, Australian news coverage is sport. So it's you know, it's something that's really constantly evolving and that we all are constantly talking about. And so this book did have to, and the stuff that I'm still learning about and thinking about, this book did have to kind of draw the line. So I just kind of thought, you know, when I was trying to finish it, I just thought about it as a poetry collection or something. You know, I tried to kind of think about, well, how did you sort of finish your poetry collection? You kind of have that to kind of lean, that experience to lean on, because, you know, this book didn't never wanted to be a definitive text, or it never wanted to be a prescriptive text. So I thought about it, you know, creatively. I think the bones are in, you know, in how it's structured, are in poetry. And I think, you know, as, you know, as someone who does write poetry, I always kind of walk into the room poem first. That's a Bob the Drag Queen reference. I think I just kind of was like, well, yeah, I just kind of have this structure and this kind of weave. And there's going to be a lot of moments and thoughts and questions and things that I could have said better and more articulately, and more conversations to be had and things that I left out. But that's for life. That's life that extends the book. And so, yeah, I sort of felt, well, I was going to say I felt very comfortable with that. Well, my publisher would probably tell you that I was having those really tense moments when I was trying to finish this book and feeling that anxiety and pressure and knowing that I'll have, you know, thoughts that could, but that's for the next book and that's for the next chapter of my life. And then ultimately the book then goes into your hands and then sort of starts that conversation, and then, you know, you guys have more articulate sort of and more, you know, sort of more layers to add to the story, how I presented it.
Anyone else keen to ask a question? Yeah? Back row?
I appreciate your comments on trans women in sport, and I think the effect of these bans and furor on trans women must have a terrible effect on the trans community. But the thing that surprises me is that no one ever wants to stop trans men playing sport. No one ever says, well, a trans man can't play rugby league or soccer or Aussie rules. Are we using, almost taking the American version of, you know, there'll be men in girls' toilets sort of thing to shock the community, but no one's ever said, oh, what happens if a woman goes into a men's toilet? You know, I just think it's been used by the right, the political right of the community, not the being right, but, you know, the conservative community to try and shock the community. Your thoughts?
Yeah, and what would you say to that, Sam? I think, yeah, it's this, you know, it's absolutely, yeah, like why, you know, as I mentioned, you know, it's trans misogyny. So it's, you know, it's, you know, wanting to sort of control this women's space in the way that there's not that same control in the men's space. I think it's really unfortunate that this is, you know, because, you know, those guidelines exist that have been approved, that have been medically approved and scientifically approved to have, you know, trans women, trans girls play in sport, but it's still, you know, this sort of like political football that's sort of kicked around, like, and this discussion of inclusion just keeps coming up in, you know, in this really sort of negative way and is really, you know, co-opted by the right, and it's you know, very much ties in, you know, with racism and white supremacist views as well. So I think, yeah, it's, of course, I have probably have a lot of thoughts on this topic that I could continue with. But did you have anything that you wanted to add to that, Sam?
I mean, I don't want to, you know. Yeah, look, I think it's an interesting point that you bring up. It's an interesting observation because you're right. There is far more focus on trans women in sport than there are on trans men. And working in this space, I think part of the reason why is because women's sport is a thing now. And it's popular, it's trendy, it's the conversation topic of the day. And there is still this widespread, incredibly insidious assumption that a trans woman is a man in a dress. Mm-hmm. And the people who are largely responsible for making decisions at administrative levels and the people who run these narratives in these media organisations are part of a framework and a worldview of thinking which is allergic to the idea that there can be anything other than man-woman. And so anything in between, it rattles them. And at the moment, it seems like a lot of the people who are so fixated on this topic, they don't have much else to do in their lives. Like, get a hobby, you know? Like, these people just want to participate. No, there hasn't been as many trans men wanting to participate at higher levels of sport, but also we don't really know because there hasn't been the media focus on them in the same way there has been on trans women.
Yeah, also.
Yeah. Thanks for your question.
One more question?
One more? Anyone? No? Perfect. All right. Well, folks, thank you so much for coming and staying a little bit longer than actually what we planned, 20 minutes longer, but I really appreciate it. Please thank again Ellen Van Niven. Amazing talk.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this recording, you can find more of them as well as information about our upcoming events via our website.